The time is almost up. Thanks for listening to Big Band Broadway and Beyond. God bless, and if anybody asks, tell them Joe sent you.
Must we let it end?
This is WHFR Dearborn from Henry Ford Community College. WHFR Dearborn is happy to produce and present to you today another edition of our local news and views public affairs show, and we call it the new WHFR Journal. Hello and welcome to another edition of the new WHFR Journal. My name is Jay Koronek, and I'm here in the studio with Dennis Reimars, our WHFR News Director. Happy holidays, Dennis.
You too.
Okay, can't hear you. Let's see. We'll find out. Let's give you a microphone. How's that?
It's possible the listeners like it better when they can't hear me.
Nah.
Can you hear me now?
Not true. That's, yes.
Okay.
But no plug to the phone company.
No, absolutely not.
No, certainly not. We can't do that. We're a non-commercial station.
Right.
Yes, you know, folks, not only non-commercial, but we are a all-volunteer student and alumni staff station here at Henry Ford Community College, with the exception of yours truly and just a couple of others. But none of us, in fact, are full-time here at WHFR.
It just feels like it.
Yeah, it seems like it to me often. But we've been doing this now for 26 years. Our 26th birthday, this is our 26th year, but our official 26-year completion birthday is coming up on December 20th. And I know there'll be a big party and celebrations worldwide because of that. Nonetheless, a little irony there. I have to tell you it's irony because you probably can't hear the irony. Nonetheless, it is radio after all. If you could see my face, then you'd know it. Nonetheless, 27th year of broadcasting will begin on December 20th, and we're happy to do this, set this example of what non-commercial media can do with an all-volunteer student and alumni staff. And Dennis, of course, is another one of those unpaid people. Sorry for you, Dennis.
No, I would do this for free. Well, obviously.
Dennis, though, does get a small stipend. He is also the editor of the Mirror newspaper here on campus at Henry Ford Community College. And I wanted to begin the show by a story that I sort of missed out as we were talking about the Bobcat last week, which was in your latest edition of the Mirror newspaper. But right next to it, right on the front page, there's a story about quite an honor or an achievement, if you will, by one of our HFCC support staff employees. So tell us about that.
I want you to help me please pronounce this name because it looks very easy, but I want to
her
make
last
sure.
Name?
Yeah.
Striz.
Striz. Okay, Stacy Striz. She is. She was elected as the new mayor of Melvindale on November 8th. Now, the article to which Jay is referring is in the. It's on the front page of the most recent. It would be issue 5 of this year of the Mirror News. It was written by Kurt Anthony Krug, who works for the college. And what he said, and I'll just read a little bit from the article. He said, "Mayor Pro Tem Stacy Striz was elected as the new mayor of Melvindale on November 8th, defeating incumbent Mayor Valerie A. Cadez, winning approximately 60% of the vote." I want to go over a little bit about this wonderful article. So I encourage people, we are out in the community, in addition on campus.
Yep.
Take a look at it. I don't want to read everything from it. But as is so common in regular papers, and we're actually incorporating this into the Mirror News now, is we're starting articles on a given page and then finishing them later. Now, that sounds like real basic newspaper, but hey, we just mastered that little particular. Uh-oh, what'd you get?
Jim Hightower wants to get started early. We'll hold him back.
Okay. All right, so what do we have here is, Striz said the entire ticket got in, six people on the council, the treasurer, and the clerk. And she was referring, of course, to Melvindale. She's a single mother of three at 33 years old. She's been active in Melvindale politics for 11 years, starting out on the youth boards of Melvindale Little League Baseball and Melvindale Junior League Football. She was elected to city council 4 years ago. A lifelong Melvindale resident, Striz is a 1996 graduate of Melvindale High School. She graduated from Henry Ford Community College in 2009 with an associate degree in general studies. She also completed work on her undergraduate degree in political science at the University of Michigan, Dearborn. Striz confessed she wasn't sure she would win the election, given that the mayor was an incumbent and a veteran politician with 16 years of experience. And Jay, we've talked about that a million times on this show, how the incumbent does have just an extremely distinct advantage, which is, of course, why on the new WHFR Journal, we try to give voice or give exposure to the challengers.
Absolutely. Well, I just want to, of course, as always, give credit to anybody who's willing to give up their privacy and a lot of their free time to serve as an elected public official. In mayor, of course, I think you mentioned, right, that it's a part-time position.
In Melvindale? Yes, absolutely.
Which is why, of course, that she's able to have a full-time job as a secretary in our very important HSCC development office here. So it's probably a couple hours a day, probably a lot of evening functions. The mayor has to be sort of a figurehead, an important figurehead for events in and around the community, and give a bunch of speeches usually. But they do have a what's called the city manager style of government. So there is a full-time person running Melvindale government. But Dearborn has a so-called strong mayor. We don't have city manager. That's part of the system. We just have the mayor. Same thing with Dearborn Heights. They have a full-time mayor also.
Did you talk about at all? I'm sorry. I was glancing through her her background. Did you talk about the fact that she was in Dearborn Public Schools K through 12 for 12 years?
No,
I didn't know that. No, I mean, and that was prior to working in the.
That is often the case, foundation. Even though we are, financially two separate business nonprofit corporations. It happened more years ago when we were actually joined as one educational entity.
Right.
But when we separated the college and the Dearborn Public Schools K-12, there we kept some connections there. So it is possible for people to have an advantage to get jobs at the college if they were in K-12, and even back and forth to a certain extent. There is a slight advantage to all of that. So,
you know, an interesting thing about this article, and again, Kurt Krug, well done, Kurt Anthony Krug, mm-hmm. The incumbent mayor, and I hope I'm pronouncing this name, Cadez, C-A-D-E-Z, okay? Valerie Cadez is the incumbent, yeah. Who just lost her position. The actual Melvindale police chief is Rick Cadez, her husband.
Wow.
So this should be interesting. So when asked what will happen with the relationship with Striz and the police chief, the old mayor's husband, she said, "We have a perfectly civilized relationship. He's a hard worker and a good person." Excellent
wow.
answer,
great.
Right?
Yeah. Sure.
But, I mean, obviously he was working with his wife for a prolonged period of time, too. So that's really interesting.
Yep.
So there we go. We have HFCC alumni employee becomes new Melvindale mayor. Thank you. Kurt
yeah,
Anthony Krug.
Absolutely. One of the next stories from the Dearborn Press and Guide last Sunday is something that was also continued in the Press and Guide Wednesday, thanks to a press release by the lawyer involved. But a lawsuit has been filed claiming that a male nurse was fired by the city for treating Muslim women. Now, this is not a real crime in my opinion. In fact, the person's lawyer, the person is John Benitez Jr.
Mm-hmm.
He has a gender discrimination lawsuit against the city, and his attorney is famous Bloomfield Hills-based lawyer Deborah Gordon. Now, Deborah's name may not immediately be well-known to people in Dearborn, but her dad was Joe Gordon.
Lou.
Okay.
There is a Joe Gordon.
I just told you his name was Lou.
Right.
Okay. Yeah, there is a Joe Gordon. Isn't there a Gordon
Chevy? You got it.
Oh, okay. Well, anyway, Lou Gordon for many, many years, 50s, 60s, 70s, was on the relatively small channel, TV broadcast channel in Detroit, Channel 50, you know, that UHF frequency that
right.
people couldn't really get well in those days. In any event, he had a a real no-holds-barred once-a-week talk show for an hour on Channel 50. And I think it was just called the Lou Gordon Show or something.
Yeah.
And he would go after, you know, local people, local opinions. He did a little celebrity stuff sometimes, but it was really one of those challenging investigative reporting, digging in-depth shows, just like this one.
Right.
No, not obviously Lou Gordon, a lot better, a lot
we
more,
get a little more
intelligent.
Money.
Yeah, and he probably retired from broadcasting, and I'm not sure, but I think he's passed away now, but sometime in the 60s. His show wasn't on beyond, I don't think, the 70s. His daughter, Deborah Gordon, is known, at least to people at Henry Ford Community College here, like myself, that back in what I think was about the 80s, we hired an instructor to the college, and I was on the hiring committee. It was in the performing arts area, in fact, and we chose a male candidate, and one of the female candidates said there was discrimination there, and she got Debbie Gordon, who was relatively new to lawyering in those days, just starting out in her career, and she was sort of championing the causes for women and gender discrimination in the workplace in general. In this case, it's a man. And she won the case, and I don't think it was justified, but in our legal system, we have a jury trial. I mean, I saw all the facts. I don't think we were discriminating against any of the female candidates or any of the other male candidates for that reason. But there was, I guess, some questions that Debbie Gordon was able to raise in the minds of the jury people, like a good trial lawyer would do in front of a jury, and almost $500,000 settlement against HFCC in those days.
Wow.
Now, just to let people know that it was a different administration, different president, different board of trustees members, well, of course, I'm the same, but most of the people on the hiring committee are no longer around here either. And even the instructor we hired has passed away, sad to say, in these last 1,000 decades. But Debbie Gordon, really gangbusters lawyer, and even without necessarily clear evidence, she was great, even in her first couple cases, as a result of this case I'm talking about came up, in making the case to the jury to get the jury to award in favor of her client. So if they get to a jury trial here, it's all over for the city. I don't care who defends it, whether, you know, for the city here. The only thing going for it, and let's describe what I said, it wasn't really a crime in my mind. This poor gentleman, and John Benitez Jr., 63 years old, was fired from his nursing job with the city's health department, the city of Dearborn's health department, you know, that was housed in the large Centennial Library in Michigan Avenue there. And the clinic's male Muslim clientele didn't like that he was treating Muslim women, like giving a shot, a flu shot, or doing other tests or whatever. The suit said that a supervisor told Benitez Jr. shortly after he began working in September 2010 that he was not to treat women wearing a hijab, okay.
Yeah, that's a scarf.
Which is the headscarf worn by Muslim women as a sign of modesty. The supervisor, an observer of Islam themselves, according to the suit, said instead that he should send the women to her. Okay, so now, Benitez, a Vietnam-era Army veteran, followed the directive until a clinic doctor saw him transitioning a Muslim woman in need of a flu shot to the nursing supervisor for care, like he was told to do. The doctor found it an unduly burdensome practice, the suit said, and ordered Benitez to continue caring for anyone who came into the clinic. Shortly thereafter, he was fired. So this poor man, he's got two supervisors, and apparently he, as a nurse, he's supposed to take orders from the doctors, and he's supposed to take orders, of course, from his supervisor. So what is he to do? Well, just because the doctor said, go ahead, you know, give her the flu shot, I'm telling you, it's going to slow it down, hold it up. I'm not sure if the supervisor was immediately available or whatever on that day, but that's our situation there. So anyway, Benitez raised objections about the different set of directions he was given, but it was to no avail. So he was just following orders. It's just a question of who had more authority there. I mean, apparently he was supposed to follow the orders of both those people. And Debbie Gordon actually, in the Wednesday edition of Press Guide, November 30th, this last Wednesday, since today, I said today is December 2nd, 2011, that's right. And she said they'd made up their mind. That was the easiest way to deal with it. He's here. We're getting complaints. They don't like it, so let's get rid of him. Well, the poor guy. I mean, absolutely. As Debbie Gordon said, I thought it was so outrageous, I wanted to take it anyway. She said that the monetary part of the damages of the claim are going to be relatively limited. One of the reasons for that is we don't have a health department anymore.
He doesn't have a place to go back if
That's
he would
right. Be. It was a budget sure. cutback last year, and the health department ended, I think, at the end of summer this year. And so in terms of future potential earnings in that job, I mean, they can't even be hired back, you know, as a way to make right what was done there. Can't even be hired back. And, in fact, how do you punish the supervisor and or the doctor? Well, they don't have jobs either because they were fired by the city,
right.
too. And maybe they were recycled somewhere. I don't know. I assume the doctor went back to his practice. But, you know, sometimes the city will try to find, like, the supervisor might be now supervising something else for the city. But nonetheless, Debbie just thought, this is outrageous how the city could let somebody be fired. Don't they have a civil service commission? Yes, they do.
Oh, I knew you were going to get that. Yeah. Was pretty good.
But, you know, who was he supposed to take the biggest order from? Didn't they tell him who the ultimate supervisor was?
You know, and if you listen to Gordon, there's a quote in here near the end. What's really interesting is she's putting the onus on the patients. She says, you don't set up a public institution and then try mm-hmm. to cater people's various religious points of view, and then on top of that, discriminate against them based on their gender. She said, I'm right. sure they can find an all-female doctor's office somewhere.
Well, and I sort of go along with the doctor here at this point. How is giving a flu shot immodest? Now, I'm not Muslim. I'm sorry. I'm not. No disrespect to the people here or their
Absolutely
interpretation.
Not.
Yes, he did touch. I assume he had to touch the arm of the woman, the naked arm, and then he punctured her arm with the needle. But I'm sorry. I'm just not in that context, and I do apologize for my lack of sensitivity. I agree with the doctor. It's just a flu shot. It's not anything immodest.
Well, and the tradition is you don't touch at all. We don't shake hands with women with the scarf. But the point is that he was given different sets of instructions, and he seemed to follow what he was told both times. And then he got fired.
If the supervisor isn't there and there's a medical procedure, you'd listen to the doctor if you're the nurse. I mean,
right.
There's a protocol.
Absolutely.
Right. Yeah. And apparently he even indicated to the doctor that the supervisor told me to pass
according to
along.
This lawsuit,
he was trying to pass the patient on to the supervisor, who, again, may not have been immediately available. The doctor said, that's burdensome for this patient. You know, just
do it. Take care of it.
Yeah. So it's just a problem of sensitivity and communication. I do think that, sorry for the city of Dearborn, they will have to pay some sort of a make good or severance fee or whatever to Mr. Benitez. He was unjustly discriminated against
because
they didn't make clear to him who his boss was. He had two bosses, and he followed the instructions of both of them.
In what you said, I just caught it at the very top of the second page because mm-hmm. I printed this out.
Yeah.
Gordon is known for taking on and usually winning high-profile wrongful discharge cases.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So Mr. Benitez definitely looks like in this case, the right attorney for him.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
All right.
Okay.
What do you got next?
Time to go on anyway. Okay.
Yes.
Well, we have a couple. This is a holiday season, of course, and believe it or not, it's a slow news time. I mean, there's a lot of tree lightings and ceremonies. They did light the seasonal tree,
right.
Can we call it Christmas tree, in the area of the Ford Community Performing Arts Building. I was driving past the City Hall last night, and I somehow expected to see that all lit up. It often is.
Yeah.
And that used to be where the tree was,
right.
The main tree that the city would light in the holiday spirit. It just says season's greetings. They have it lit up in lights, and that's it. The rest of the City Hall park, if you will, is totally dark.
I wonder if they're showing their economic discretion there.
Well, I'm sure, yeah. And whatever display there is with a variety of seasonal objects, like snowballs, snowmen, whatever,
right.
Is over at the Ford Community Performing Arts Center, where the tree was and where the lighting was.
Which is actually more centrally located.
Yeah, and it's a nice setting. They have maybe, I don't know exactly how it's displayed there. I'm sure it's lovely. But in any event, that's already been done. So, but there's other things coming up, and we want you to stay in a positive spirit end of the year, not the shop till you drop or riot to get a discounted toy or something. That's not the spirit that I understand.
No.
Which should, you know, a spirit of peace, love, and joy should continue through the year, and I wish it would. That's my holiday wish, so there. So we have some tips here. Well, we may wait to the end. That for some reason, there's fire prevention tips and wise holiday decisions from the two chiefs out in Dearborn Heights. That is Chief Andy Gurka of their fire department and Police Chief Lee Gavin, both of whom we've had on the show several times. Mm-hmm. Very intelligent and I'm sure very capable people. It sounds like, since they both appeared in the paper the same week, is that either it's something they do every year or the city said, get those tips out there. You know, it's because they both appeared in the same week, so they must have had a deadline. Get your tips to the paper.
Yeah, because they don't want to copy off each other.
And we don't have any tips directly from the Dearborn representatives. They just probably didn't release him yet.
Yeah.
But they're very interesting. And word to the wise man, we'll get back to that. I wanted to comment on briefly the Tuesday Forum show that we did this week. It's 11/29/11.
Yep.
It was Dearborn Heights News and Views.
So it was with Ned.
Ned Apigian, one of the Dearborn Heights councilmen, who was recently reelected. He won a sort of a replacement election about 2 years ago, and this was the full big-time election, and he was one of the top three out of the five candidates over there. Well, he hosts the show for us, and he has done that even before he was a councilman, about Dearborn Heights. But I feel sorry for him a little bit because he's on the fifth Tuesday.
Yeah.
Not of the months that have a fifth Tuesday. Yeah. So it's about once every 3 months, sometimes every second month. But we had a great show. And for those of you interested in budget issues and city assessment issues and the budget projections, Dearborn Heights is an awful lot like, in terms of the restrictions and requirements and cost overruns, a lot like Dearborn. But Dearborn is maybe twice the size on average of Dearborn Heights in terms of, probably even more than that in terms of budget. And we had the Dearborn Heights city assessor, the Dearborn Heights comptroller, who is their budget person. That's what he does, and in fact, it's even in their website. It's kind of interesting. He doesn't meet the people. His office is not open to the public.
Right. He's not accessible.
No, it's not a public office.
Not at all.
It's interesting. He's busy trying to figure out how they're going to pay the bills.
I don't have time.
And how they're going to get more money for next year. And it was very nice to actually see this non-public officer come over here to the college and speak with the other people. The third member of Dearborn Heights government that we got was the human resource director. And she's actually an adjunct faculty member over here at Henry Ford Community College teaching math.
Wow.
It's interesting that these days, human resource director, the personnel director, the person that does hiring and benefits packages and so on, that the qualification is a math degree.
Yeah.
It used to be a psychology degree years ago because you wanted people that could work together well and weren't crazy and wouldn't get angry and violent. But no, don't worry about that. It's a math degree now you need because of all the complexities of pay and withholding and taxes and pensions, of course, and health care. It's all a matter of dollars
and
cents.
It is relevant. You're right.
It's totally relevant.
Kind of weird. I was thinking the comptroller probably teaches dance or Spanish. But
well,
no.
I didn't check on that, but
no,
maybe,
I doubt
maybe
it.
True. So all those people, thank you for coming over here. I didn't mention their names, but you should, listeners, okay, you know where the podcast is, and maybe you're listening to the podcast for the new WHFR Journal because you're not available on Fridays from 1 to 2 p.m. to listen to it live. Well, just go back to the site when you're done listening to this show, of course. Don't go now. And go to the talk show button and then Tuesday Forum. And then 11/29, it's labeled Dearborn Heights News and Views. And listen to that hour. Just an insight here. I found out things, and I said so on the show since I couldn't resist jumping in. I was around for the taping and helping Ned here. That I never knew, for example, about one thing. Of course, I know I don't know an awful lot. I know that. Okay. But what I do know, oh boy, look out. No. Okay, one example, the city assessment of your property. Okay, you pay a millage, and that's based on your property value. And so if your property value goes down, the assessor is looking at home sales in your area, and there's other objective criteria. You know, the assessor can't just oh, I think it's worth more. I think it's worth less. It's based on objective criteria, and that's prevents lawsuits and so on. I mean, there's a little question if the property value has gone up because you built a garage that wasn't there or put in a patio or a swimming pool or something. Sure, your property value goes up a little bit, and the city assessor does have to sort of add a few hundred bucks or whatever to the home value there. But as Ned Apigian mentioned, and I've heard here in Dearborn, some people in both of these cities have said, wait a minute, my taxes have gone up. And this is before the millage increases that were approved, too, which will raise a little more money from everybody. But they said, look, values are going down. I'm paying more than I paid in cash dollars in the past. And so we asked the Dearborn Heights City Assessor, how can this be? Well, it seems that there's more than just the actual property values as an objective criteria. The CPI is one of the other ones. This is Consumer Price Index.
Wow.
If the price of a variety of goods all equated equally, you know, we pay for gasoline and food and rent and, you know, stuff at Walmart. If the general price of all the stuff in the U.S. that somebody in Washington, D.C. computes as the CPI, if that goes up, your property taxes go up in Dearborn and Dearborn Heights. That boggled my mind.
Yeah.
Dennis, did you ever hear that the CPI was a factor in all this?
No.
And we were told point blank that yes, it is. And that's why some people, it's because costs have gone up in our society for a variety of the things that we need to buy. And so some people, and of course, property values don't go up or down in every neighborhood. So if you're in a very classy neighborhood, maybe the values don't drop as much, or maybe they do. It all depends on a number of factors. But that's an objective thing, the property value. Realtors could tell you about why those values go up or down. That's objective. But even if your property value has gone down, you may wind up paying more in dollars. And I think there's two major other reasons. I can't remember the other one, but I think I sort of understood that. But the CPI, I couldn't understand.
Right.
Who the heck put the CPI into property value computation for raising tax dollars? Who did that? It's probably everywhere in the U.S. they have to do it that way.
Right, I would think so if it's here.
Federal law. But how is that relevant? So the next time the city assessor, Dearborn Heights, didn't know. Couldn't say, well, it's just, that's the way it's done. Well, who did it that way?
Did it make sense to the assessor? Because that's the way it was done, sure.
Well, I think her name was Elizabeth. She was being very objective and said, well, we just have to do it that way. That's, you know, the law says so. So it's, we don't have any say over that. Well, I'm asking our politicians, why is that? Now, I can understand maybe they want something to balance off the decline in property value. But that there's only a couple people that get hit by that, so that their payments to, you know, on their property go actually up because of the CPI.
So with this, is the CPI when people are buying homes, is that calculated?
Well, it shouldn't be, but maybe it's only CPI on homes, but that's not right because they're paying is only going down.
But not only that, but it's an apples to oranges comparison,
right?
Based on different areas. I mean, geography is everything, isn't it? Not only in business, but in residence.
Location.
So whatever. If everything is square footage two houses are exactly the same square footage and everything, where they're actually located may make a difference.
Yes.
You know?
That's what I would think. Okay. Well, okay. So please listen to that show. It's called, and of course, there is a different topic every week. And Dearborn Heights News and Views is only the fifth Tuesday of any month that has a fifth Tuesday, and it was the Tuesday Forum show on our archive on our website whfr.fm this last Tuesday, 11/29/11. So listen to that. You may be amazed at what goes into these budget plans. I tried at the end to toss out a general question: what do each of you think should be done for the future of budgets for the city of Dearborn Heights and Dearborn? Even what recommendations do you have? And they all laughed and deferred.
Yeah.
No answers, folks. That's scary. There's no easy answers here.
No, that's right.
It's, you know, tighten your belt, cut some services, let the politicians decide if they can pass even higher taxes. But it's very, very difficult. I thought we'd segue from that to the issue in Detroit. In fact, even today, there's obviously, some investigative team from Governor Snyder's office, Michigan Governor Snyder, that's his name, you know, just because it looks like the city of Detroit is going to go broke sometime next spring or next summer for sure. And that means the state has an obligation to help save the city in some way, save its basic existence anyway, by sending in an emergency manager, emergency city manager. It is amazing to me how many cities in Michigan are running under a state-appointed emergency city manager right now. I think Benton Harbor still is. I think Flint is. So the governor has to send a team in to investigate and decide how to go about doing this. When do they actually need to arrive? And Detroit Mayor Bing has already been quoted, at least this morning anyway, if not last night, as saying, we're not going to let anybody but Detroiters decide on Detroit issues. So some people were saying, well, maybe they'll appoint Bing as emergency city manager.
No, that's a total conflict.
No, at all. Well, he's a Detroiter, I guess.
Yeah, but that's the only logical thing.
Right. So somewhere here, I have Jack Lessenberry's editorial, and I know it's it's under this other pad here from last week's Metro Times, because he, you know, he's often cantankerous and takes the outsider's opinion on this show, the new WHFR Journal, local news, and alternative views. That alternative stuff, you get that? That means that it's ideas you probably hadn't considered, or you wouldn't consider at length, but maybe you should. And this is what he had to say. He actually thinks that emergency manager for Detroit would be good. Now, this is anti-democratic, anti-progressive, and if you know Jack Lessenberry, okay. And he does begin this by saying, what I'm about to say may get me a lot of hate mail, but sorry, I disagree. I think having the right emergency manager for a time might turn out to be a good thing for Detroit. And we know it's not a popular opinion. Okay. And he says, even Ron Williams, the founder of the Metro Times newspaper, and a man that Lessenberry has infinite respect for, sent him a plea recently to fight the law. You know, it was a petition drive that may be on the ballot next year to remove the second emergency city manager law that was passed this last January by the legislature. That one is where the state basically can come in at any time and take over a city, whether it's bankrupt, whether it requests help or not. So there still is a previous city manager law that the state has in place, but the kick-in period is later, and it's more difficult. But at this point, whenever the governor says a city needs emergency management, they just move in, and they can let go all contracts, all the city council, sweep it all away just because the governor says, I want to do this, or we need to have this done. A lot of us, including myself, and apparently Mr. Ron Williams of the Metro Times, feels that's going way too far. That's not democracy. That's second law.
Didn't Snyder say the reason why he wanted to is because that would help, it would be able to catch it earlier before there were bigger problems, and therefore we would eliminate it and then be out earlier?
It's that ongoing threat that may get people's attention earlier.
But he tried to sell it as preventive medicine. Look, if we get in there early enough, then we'll be able to get out quicker.
Right.
More quickly.
Yep.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yep. Wink, wink.
All right. So the editorial goes on. Here's his reasons. Here's, and I can't read all the words, but you have to go to MetroTimes.com for last week's edition, November 23rd edition of the Metro Times, okay, to read it completely for yourself. So Lessenberry says, why do I think this might be a good thing? Number one, Detroit government is terribly broken and dysfunctional. In a way, it's so far proven impossible for elected leaders to repair. The basic problem is this. What was once a prosperous city of nearly 2 million people is now a largely dilapidated and shrunken one of barely 700,000, mostly very poor people. In addition to vast debts and current budget deficit, I think is reason number two, he doesn't number them, but I am trying to, the city has a social services and public employee sector built for a larger, richer city and can no longer sustain it. So in other words, you don't need as many people for a city this small a size to be on city payrolls. He says there have been layoffs and more salary cuts and layoffs and salary cuts. And as I write this, the mayor and the council are squabbling further about how many more workers to dump. Alas, none of this will work except to slightly postpone the inevitable. The city is trying to deal with its problems by using a, quote, salami tactics, unquote, which is, and Dennis is taking notes on this, cut a little and then a little more. How does that work with salami?
It doesn't make any sense.
Is instead dying a death of 1,000 cuts. So I just want one big chunk of salami.
Yeah.
Not all the little slices. Yeah, okay, whatever.
You don't even eat salami.
No, I don't. Oh, well. Whether the city runs out of cash next April or July or limps along to September, Lessenberry says, really doesn't make very much difference. What's needed is to start all over again. Some equivalent of zero-based budgeting. That can only realistically happen under emergency manager. Yes, they may throw out union contracts that are no longer sustainable. This will happen in some form anyway, he says. There are two recent real-world examples that have helped me come to this conclusion, one from the public sector, one from the private. The first is Hamtramck, that's it, which landed under what was then called an emergency financial manager. That was the original law we had, which we still have, back in the year 2000. Largely because of the irresponsibility of many generations of its politicians. Lou Bud Schimmel was appointed EFM then and made a lot of decisions that were wildly unpopular, but they also got the city back on its feet, and it emerged much healthier 7 years later. Everybody, I guess that's true. I've been out to Hamtramck recently, but I know that they have a downtown area and have some blues musicians coming back down there again, so there must be some activity, at least in the downtown business district.
And there used to be, and I've not heard otherwise, it used to be one of the highest concentrations of nightlife, meaning bars, but for the entertainment and food and things like that in the metro area. So
right, yep. Okay, well, and then his second example is General Motors.
Yeah.
Well, that's a big example. Less than 3 years ago, it too was on the rocks, and it went to the government and begged for a bailout. Essentially, President Obama became GM's emergency manager and soon sent in a surrogate. What was the result? The company was reorganized. And, you know, for years, it just would never, never wake up to the reality that it needed that. There was a corporate bureaucracy, and a large-sized one, too,
right. That
just wanted to keep things the same, even though their sales, their competition was outdoing them, the quality was dropping down, everything. I mean, they had an electric car and then said, we don't really want to do this. They could have been on top of the world if they just would have kept developing. The original electric car wasn't great, the EV1 back in 1990-something, but it was definitely the right start in the right direction, and people wanted it, and they just have their head in the sands, all the corporate management at GM, with the exception of the guy from Chrysler that went over there, Lutz. Is that his name?
Bob Lutz.
He was a car guy. He came from Chrysler.
Right.
I think he started Ford, but he went to Chrysler and helped Chrysler in its renewal. And he started the Cadillac division on its sort of performance-oriented high style, and he really made them come alive. But he couldn't change. In fact, he's got a biography out that details his conflict with that head-in-the-sand behemoth of General Motors. And of course, a good capitalist would say, should let him go broke.
Okay? Absolutely.
But the transition would have hurt a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yeah, I think they deserve to go broke. They deserve to go out of business. Running a business like that, and even Roger and me, Michael Moore's first big time documentary from the early 90s about the insensitivity of Chairman Smith, Roger Smith was his name, about laying people off in Flint. At the Buick plant there, and basically killing Flint. We can't make money, and the plant's too old to fix, so we're just going to lay people off, and with no respect for the public or the employees at all that I saw at that time. And so I think, GM deserved to go broke because of what it did and how it acted for decades. Too big to fail? Let them fail anyway, because they deserve it. No, but the hurt and harm caused short term, not just to the economy, whatever that is, but to all those individuals, the employees especially,
right.
That maybe that shouldn't be allowed to happen.
Because you can't punish a handful of the decision makers.
Right. It was definitely the Democrats and Obama, although many Republicans voted for it finally too, to give a little bit of money. I mean, the TARP money, $750 billion. Now it was revealed, in fact, just this week, I don't know if you caught this, Dennis, on Fox News, but the actual amount of money that had been funneled under by Fannie Mae to the banks was closer to $7.5 trillion at no interest expected in that same period of time. So the $750 that was publicized was nowhere near the money they were funneling in to the banking system to keep it afloat. Nobody found out about that. It was kept secret the $7.7 trillion, which is 11 times more than the TARP money, some of which didn't go to the banks. It went to, but, you know, Detroit, oh, there was only, what, $3 to $5 billion? It's just a pittance to keep the auto industry of the United States of America alive in any form. And of course, it's worked out, except that, you know, Ford didn't need the takeout money, right. the rescue money. Good for them.
They were gloating about that.
Well,
they deserve to.
They deserve to. Good management. They saw bad times coming, and they got ready for them. And of course, Chrysler wound up being bought by Fiat. But at least the factories are still open, and Chrysler is up 45% in sales over last year, which were only about two or three cars. So 45% is not that much increase. But and I think the Fiat chief executive, is it Marcioni, that he's very smart about car sales. He is a car guy. And coming into the U.S. market is, again, after many years, is a difficult challenge. But I think he's at least got the Chrysler brands. And I've seen the improvements in the cars. And I'm a car guy, you know, and I know about transmissions and engines and so on and handling. The Jeep has been much improved.
It's a little since smaller he got now, there. Isn't it? Doesn't it look more like a...
Well, they haven't changed the body design. The Grand Cherokee is a relatively new model, but it's still basically a two-seat vehicle.
Yeah.
Four-passenger, five-passenger. But the styling has improved. That's not what I care about. I just think safety, handling, the engines, he made sure that those things were going to get better. Initially, they made, like, better interiors, because interiors were always cheap and always gray for all the Chrysler line. I even wrote him a letter complaining years ago. I said, I'm not going to buy a car from you. They're always cheap and always gray on the inside. And that was true. They basically were. But, you know, or you could get dark gray or light gray. You had a big choice there, dark or light gray.
Yeah.
So he's got all kinds of colors and great fabrics. And so they did that right away because that was the first thing they could easily do is upgrade the interior. But then this year they have a new six-cylinder engine coming from the, I think it's called Pentastar, coming from the Trenton engine plant. And it's a great engine. And, of course, their Hemi is still there. And they've redesigned their... And the next wave is going to be even better for them, I think, with some of the European styles and influences. The Fiat 500 is for sale now in the U.S. Very small car, 38 miles to a gallon, though, and kind of cute. I mean, they got J-Lo in the ads, so it's got to be cute.
Yeah,
right?
There you go.
Okay. So anyway, and this is important in going back to Jack Lessenberry's editorial about bringing in this emergency financial manager. He says, nobody will say this on record, but some are worried about the possibility of civil unrest. That's right. Not just riots from the, not just Occupy groups in our parks, but riots, protesting, government, lack of sensitivity to the population in one way or the other. And Jack says, sadly, that probably means it would be a bad idea to name an emergency manager who was not African-American for the city of Detroit. Well, naming Lou Schimmel, a white accountant from Waterford, wouldn't work here. Schimmel is now the EM in Pontiac. That's the other city didn't know.
That's
Pontiac.
Right. That's right. I kept thinking Wayne, but no, it's Pontiac.
Is under emergency city manager.
That's right.
Nor would it be a good idea to name Dave Bing to the job. I just mentioned Bing was talked about. He said that would set a terrible precedent. He has already announced he intends to run for re-election in 2 years. Every mayor in the country probably has had a fantasy of not having to worry about the council or the unions and having absolute power. Helping them fulfill it would in no way be healthy. The best person I can think of as an emergency manager for Detroit is Joe Harris. Harris is now the emergency manager in Benton Harbor. Yeah, they're still under EM. He was Detroit's auditor for a decade.
Okay.
And obviously must be African-American because of what Jack said might be needed here. And he said, and he knows how the city's finances work, or don't work, I would add.
Right.
There may be, however, better people. It needs to be said, says Lessenberry, that it's possible, even likely, the whole process will get put on hold. A group called Stand Up for Democracy is now collecting signatures to put a measure on the November 12 ballot asking voters if they want to repeal Snyder's emergency manager law, as I said earlier, the one from last January. And they only need 161,000 some valid signatures to do that. And I think they've already got it, to tell you the truth. They need to get those signatures by the end of this year.
Right.
But from what I know, they haven't had much trouble. I don't know. We'll see what happens there. And but he says he hopes it plays out. And it just, you know, if you start from zero and you have an objective person, maybe you can get things back on track somehow.
I wouldn't think it would be difficult to get people to sign that particular petition, do you? I mean, it's
No, because, well, it gives the, again, it actually does give the governor absolute power over management of all the cities and can negate all the elected officials' power. They can stay a city council, but they can't do anything.
But they don't have any power.
And the mayor has no power and get rid of all the contracts. And then the EM can do anything they want to. So that is blatantly undemocratic. I know that Snyder, and it's probably true, it's a great threat to get people's houses in order.
Right.
But I'm just look at the trend here, folks. We've got 5-6 cities in Michigan under emergency management. I mean, that. What, is the state going to take over management of all the cities? Eventually?
What's next? And then I think most people can look at it and see the value of a system of checks and balances where one person isn't making all the decisions, or even a small group of people.
I hate to use a national example, but here's a thing. Congress or the Justice Department has approved the president's power, and whether it's Obama or whoever, but they've approved the fact that the president, first of all, can... it's a 007 license to kill thing, can indicate who is to be killed anywhere in the world.
Assassinated, they used.
Assassinated.
Yeah.
Terminated with extreme prejudice.
Yeah, very
but
well
also
said.
Applies now to a U.S. citizen, because there was one that was helping Al-Qaeda or something,
That's right. He
was hiding out overseas, but he was a U.S. citizen, and therefore theoretically entitled to protection of laws. Now, of course, there we have that Patriot Act, which is not patriotic at all, in my opinion, that says the government, maybe not even the president, you know, somebody in Homeland Security, some petty bureaucrat, can say, this person is a terrorist, I think.
It was a committee set up by Obama.
Okay. But
right.
Going back from the assassination, they can send these suspected terrorists immediately to prison. No trial.
Right.
That's been true since the Patriot Act started.
Right.
Okay,
absolutely.
And that means U.S. citizens as well as foreigners. Just round them up and put them in jail. I thought that was what the SS did in Germany.
Yeah,
I thought that's what Stalin did with his secret police.
Yep.
In the middle of the night, people come and arrest you. Well, we used to. We don't actually now. If anybody in government says they're a terrorist, they can grab us and put us in prison. But now they can also kill us by the president's okay. Talk about undemocratic.
And from what I understand, the way the process works, and again, this is just, I mean, nobody's going to put it in black and white for us, but apparently there is a committee set up, a committee set up by the mm-hmm. executive branch, and then the people, the targets, whatever you want to call them, the potential casualties will be reviewed by the president and then determined mm-hmm. from there. I mean, this is real. We're talking, you and I are talking like this is science fiction.
Yeah,
this
absolutely.
This can happen right now.
Yep.
That's crazy.
Yeah. And he said, well, they wouldn't do that unless they really had to. Excuse me, if they want to, they can, and that seems dangerous to me.
Stormtroopers in the middle of the night.
You really want to try? I thought the Tea Party group taught us something. You don't really want to trust government that much to do the right thing, even most of the time. You want to have some checks and balances, as you said earlier. That's what I think our forefathers, or five fathers, whatever it was, put into the Constitution and the Bill of Rights is checks and balances.
It's such a simple thing to, you know, you were an only child, weren't you?
Yes.
It
shows?
Well, no. Okay. But the reason why I bring that up, and I'm sure you had friends over, one of the exercises that my mom was, she was just famous for this. I had a brother and we were very competitive, and give you an example of the piece of cake. We want to split the cake. She would have mm-hmm. one person cut it, the other one choose.
Mm-hmm.
That was, you know, we grew up in checks and balances. You have to when you have a sibling that you argue with.
I think so.
But yeah. I think that carries over. Something as simple as that, as one person does this, the other person gets to choose. That way everything's fair.
Well,
you know me, I
oversimplify. We'll see how it works out. I have a couple comments queued up from Jim Hightower now again, and since he wanted to get his opinion out earlier, we're just going to do one of them because this is WHFR.FM, the station making waves, and there's only about 12 minutes to go because we just... Dennis and I love to talk.
Wow.
Thank you for continuing to listen. And I know you are continuing to listen, because if you're not, you can't hear me saying this. All right.
Yeah, so
here's
there.
Jim Hightower.
Perhaps you're part of Wall Street's richest 1%. Yet, deep in the deepest part of your hedge fund heart, you secretly support the We Are the 99% people. Taking a big step even further, you might actually desire to join the Occupy Wall Street movement in one of its tent camps to show your solidarity. But my goodness, there's just no way you can settle into one of those grungy plastic tents that the movement people are in. Well, fret no more, my uber-rich friend, for that's why Neiman Marcus exists. In the nick of time, the luxury retailer has come out with its Christmas book, featuring 171 pages of fabulous gift ideas for the fabulously wealthy. And there it is, on page 6263, in a four-color spread, the Dream Folly Tent. It's an 18-foot diameter yurt that, according to the catalog description, is inspired by the whimsical TV show I Dream of Jeannie. And what a whimsy it is, with an opulent interior that, as Neiman puts it, goes beyond your wildest, most decadent dreams. You'll sink into a bevy of one-of-a-kind, down-filled designer pillows, zone out on the tent's fine textiles in colors selected, quote, to evoke the bubbles of a warm, soothing bath, and be protected from even the darkest of nights by a custom handcrafted crystal chandelier. The catalog assures purchasers that Neiman Marcus can have a dream tent installed on your estate grounds in the blink of an eye. And if the company can deliver in, say, the Hamptons, how hard would it be to set you up in a downtown Occupy encampment? This is Jim Hightower saying, yes, even the wealthiest elites can stand with the people, then withdraw to their dream tents. Prices start at $75,000. While that's a bit pricey, imagine the solidarity it will build with those protesting the excesses of Wall Street elites.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's populist take on what the powers that be are up to. Find out more at hightowerlowdown.org.
The new WHFR Journal, still in progress, yes, for December the 2nd, 2011. Jay Kornick and Dennis Reimer is with you here. We were just talking in the studio about upcoming events, and there's several. One, what do I do with it? Tonight and tomorrow night, there is a dance recital here at the college.
Oh, yeah.
Live, on stage.
Full Circle Dance Company.
Full Circle Dance Company. And darn, I don't have it now, but it's obviously in the evening. Sometime.
What do you want to know about it?
Oh, Dennis knows everything.
Well, no, huh? it's in the
he put
mirror
it in
news.
His mirror newspaper.
Sure.
Okay, well, that's one way to make sure that we do it.
Yeah.
Because Dennis can't forget what's in there.
It's Friday, December 2nd. Actually, it's the tonight. Full Circle Dance Company will present the Full Circle Concert 2011 tonight and tomorrow, both at 8 p.m. in the Adderay Auditorium, which, of course, is in the McKenzie Fine Arts Center on the western part of our campus.
Mm-hmm. Well, it'd be a nice thing to do with the family. I think it's $5 for students and $10 for others. But remember, folks, the money helps support these sponsored activities. And at this time of year, it's very important for you to know that most of our activities, including the Mirror newspaper and others, the Mirror, you have to try to ask for money for ads. And,
absolutely.
You know, in order to keep going, the budget from the college doesn't pay for all of it, and that comes from student fees anyway.
But don't even get started on the adopt a family and the things that we get involved in, you know.
And WHFR, we need money, and music department and theater department. So this will be helping support, and it's always a lot of fun. They have music, and they're usually it's a holiday theme dance. And what time does it start tonight
and
tomorrow?
It starts at 8 p.m. Both tonight and tomorrow.
Okay.
And like you said, it's $10 for general admission, $5 for students and seniors. And Christmas Rocks in Socks will open the show, a staging of Snow from the Nutcracker, the classic two-act ballet.
Okay.
We'll begin the second half, and the show is for all ages.
That's great fun, yeah. So maybe you can make it to that. If you just want to do something different, get out of the house.
There you go.
Live music or live dance, what the heck, you know, that's great for the holiday season. Okay, I think I'm, here it is, the world's largest book signing.
Okay. This is great.
This is next week, Saturday, December 10th, and it's going to be from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m., and it has to be that long because it is the largest, it's the world's largest book signing. I'm not sure that Guinness Book of Records has a category like that.
I don't think they do yet.
Maybe they should apply here, that there'll be more than 100 of the writers who contributed stories to an anthology about the history of Dearborn. That book, we mentioned that there was a deadline for submitting stories a couple months ago. It's published, folks.
That may be the record.
Somebody had a Xerox machine in their basement,
yeah.
I guess. But it's published, and all more than 100 of the writers, I'm not sure that it's all the writers, more than 100 of the people who contributed anecdotes about the history of Dearborn, some of her are hilarious, I'm sure, or amazing, but true, they're going to be there.
So you can get this book and get it signed by the authors from particular stories.
If you can spend time enough to get 100 signatures.
Well, maybe you pick and
choose. Go down the line.
Right, right.
That's why it's 10 to 4. It'll take you 6 hours to go through all of
them. You may not know the answer to this, but we can buy this ahead of time, right? I mean, we can actually have this in hand, read it, and then go there and search out the authors, do you think? I asked him something. Sorry about that.
Book orders and donations can be sent to the museum. So
okay,
I think you have to go to the Dearborn Historical Museum and maybe buy it there.
Yeah.
It doesn't say that it's available anywhere else. Obviously, we don't have borders in Dearborn.
Right. Don't remind me.
The book is priced at $19.95 in soft color, cover, 382-page book.
Wow.
Includes stories about digging up bones in the backyard, breaking into labs to rescue animals, hiding in church after lockup time, substituting for Ford during a portrait sitting.
Oh, that's great.
Getting cussed out by Hubbard, the former mayor.
Yeah.
And discovering what a hockey... That's a moment in history. Things to tell the grandkids.
I got cussed
mayor
out.
Mayor Hubbard cussed me out. Wow. Yeah.
Did you deserve it? That's not the point.
Yeah. Moment in time. Discovering a hockey opponent who kept falling down in practice.
Okay.
Had a hat trick up his sleeve. So in any event, you can see the museum. You can buy it there. Or certainly come on by and buy it and get it autographed by some of these people. Maybe some of them you know. Probably I know some of them.
That's true.
And Glenn O'Cray, who is vice chair of the Dearborn Historical Commission, in charge of vice, I guess.
He sat in this chair, hasn't he?
Yes, he's been here. We talked to him out at the Dearborn Farmers Market.
That's right.
About the related issue, somewhat related, Historical Commission.
Right.
The library.
It was
in favor
library.
Of keeping the library open. And... of course, we partially failed in that because no library is now closed, but at least the millage support for the library, not total pay of the cost of the library, but one mill, as you folks remember, did get passed. Well, anyway, Glenn says here, the largest book signing I could find online in history around the world, I had only 87 authors.
Okay.
And so also they're going to be wearing T-shirts identifying each of us as a Best Dearborn Stories famous author. So if you want to know who to ask for an autograph, just go to the person with the Best Dearborn Stories T-shirt.
They'll probably have a name tag that you can associate with the article, too. So
yeah.
What they're saying, and what I gather from this article, is they can't prove that this is the largest book signing, but it sounds like it.
Yeah.
And from what they could find, it's pretty darn close.
Well, it'd be a great thing. Most of the money is going to go to support the Dearborn Historical Society. They have three buildings. They need money, just like every Dearborn resource. The city has to consider cutting $8.5 million yet from this year's budget by next June. So you don't necessarily, if you value our having a historical museum and the several activities each year they do, to see it go under. Now, they had a new membership drive last July, and they raised $35,000 since then, but they need more. So they're starting a major fundraising drive this year to help people, and they're even considering the sale of naming rights to its three buildings. So if you want your name on the historical museum, I thought the name should be Dearborn Historical Museum.
Yeah, I mean, that's part of the history. That's funny.
Glenn O'Cray's Historical Museum on the behalf of Dearborn.
In some circles, historical museums are considered a luxury, that they're not a necessity, and we don't. And coming from your background in teaching and history especially, we see the value.
Well, of course. Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah. If you don't remember the past, you're doomed to repeat all the mistakes of the past.
Yeah, you deserve to.
And I wish more museums would preserve more of the mistakes.
Oh, great call.
It's really true.
Yeah.
I mean, museums, this is the high point of the past. What about the low points, the ones we should never do again? Only good history profs point that out.
Yeah. You're right.
And emphasize that. For example, and they don't coach it this way, but around holiday times, I'm in favor of peace education. Most history classes, high school, elementary, high school, and college, they talk about, the mistakes of the past, but they put it in the context of an honorable war.
Right.
And it was honorable from the perspective of the people that won it.
Right.
But the people that died and believed otherwise, they were on the wrong side.
Yeah.
Well, obviously they're dead or they're disenfranchised because of the people that won it. But war is never good. War is never a winner. So most of the mistakes of the past, I'd say most all of them, were wars.
Yeah.
Because people died. We killed our own kind. Imagine. Yes, all human species. We are the same. We are one of the few species on this planet of creatures that kill their own kind. It just doesn't make sense. It is crazy, crazy, crazy. And yet we do it, and we don't even think twice about it. So those mistakes of the past, we need to learn from and never let that happen again. But there's other mistakes in the past, too.
Yeah, but
if you talk about only mistakes, you'll never talk about the high points. But I think a lot of the high points are the negotiated peace settlements and the countries that live for 200 years without war, let's say, or whatever.
Yeah, I would think that
we need to find out how that happened and make it happen more. So we have to take the good things from the past that aren't usually covered and the terrible things like the wars and turn it all around. So, yeah, I love history, and we're going to, you know, we'll touch on this as we can around here. Those of us who are a little bit older and have read a little bit more, we understand the value of learning about the past. Okay. Whatever else we'd like to cover here, we have a couple of minutes before Joanne Korchinska and Highway 61 Blues
get
started. Can I
just throw this in real quick? The Dearborn Animal Shelter reduces cat and kitten adoption fees. This is kind of cool. There's a two-day window, which is Friday and Saturday. You know what is today? It's today and tomorrow.
Okay,
the two-day window, cat adoption fees will be reduced to $5 per cat. They're 4 months and older, mm-hmm. and kittens will be $40 for the first kitten and only $10 more to add a second kitten.
Wow.
So, yeah, that's substantially cheaper.
I saw a couple of weeks ago, it was like they had 354 cats
mm-hmm.
that needed adoption.
Yep, and they have a lot of them. The number there is 313-943-2697. That's 313-943-2697.
If you just want to drive by, folks, it's not on Michigan Avenue, of course, it's so you might find it easily. You go down Greenfield. Go past Rotunda, go under the bridge mm-hmm. or the crossover, the overpass from 94, and it's the first driveway on the right. And as
right
you go
as it
up
turns
there,
into Allen Road.
Turn
right.
left. No. You
it's not
before
that curve.
You get to Allen Road.
Oh, okay.
No, it's way before there. So after you've gone under the I-94 overpass, the first road takes you up the hill. If you turn right, you're getting to the DPW.
That's
that is
right.
The Dearborn Public Works place. And if you want to go see our sewage and trash, sure, take a tour there. I'm not sure they give tours. Mm, that might be hazardous.
I think so.
Need a hazmat suit to go on a tour there. But turn left immediately, and that's the parking lot for the Dearborn Animal Shelter, run by the Friends of the Dearborn Animal
Shelter.
Great organization. Elaine Green and all the others there, volunteers working for very little money under contract to the city of Dearborn, and they've really turned that whole place around in the last 20-some years that they've been doing this, and it's another example of a great community service nonprofit entity helping the city out in difficult times and doing an extraordinarily great job. Now, yeah, they need a new facility, but right now they're overcrowded with cats and kittens, and always breaks my heart to see the pictures because I want to adopt all of them.
Yeah.
I have one cat right now, but you know, if you need a pet for the holidays, they will counsel you on you know whether or not you are the right family for the animal. And you say, well, how dare they tell me if I'm qualified?
No, they take this seriously.
Yeah, but do you have the money? Do you know what's required
right.
with cleaning, grooming, feeding, watering, exercising these animals? So they have cats and dogs, of course, available. And if you're interested in some other kind of pet that is easily domesticated, they have shelters or foster homes, if you will, that have other animals that can be adopted too. Like some people might like a guinea pig.
Sure.
I had one, and they don't do much, and they don't